All right, Alexander, let's talk about what is happening in Ukraine, what is going on in the front line. The ceasefire, the three-day ceasefire, obviously, that's all concluded now. The last couple of days, we had very big Russian drone and missile strikes into Ukraine, and Ukraine continues to launch their drones into Russia, around 200 to 250 drones every other day or so. They're also launching into Russia. One thing is clear, Ukraine's air defenses are badly depleted. You can tell by the interception rates of the Russian missiles and drones, which even Ukraine now is acknowledging that they're not able to intercept the drones and the Russian missiles. And then we have the continuing narrative of a stalemate.
Yes.
Which it's not a stalemate. There's not a stalemate going on. And by the way, you may also want to bring in the Financial Times article, which claims that in autumn, Putin is going to take Donbass. That's the plan. The Russian military to take Donbass, and then they're going to issue new terms to Ukraine. Something that we've been saying for a while now. You brought it up that most likely you would be looking at Donbass, which is the main battle. That would be the battle that's going to be concluded. And once that's concluded, Russia and Putin will come out with new terms to the West. So anyway, your thoughts on Ukraine, or where do you want to begin in all of this?
Well, let's start with the drones, because yes, Ukraine does continue to make drone attacks on Russia. And these are a problem for the Russians, and they've been an embarrassment for Putin. And there's information that the head of the Russian aerospace forces, a man called Avzalov, has been sacked. The word, by the way, is that this is about the Tuapse affair, that the thing that provoked his sacking was the Tuapse episode. But to repeat a point that we have made many times, these Ukrainian drone attacks, damaging though they can be, able to kill civilians as they sometimes do, able sometimes to inflict serious damage like they did on Tuapse, are not going to ultimately change the direction of the war or affect the state of the Russian economy or cause a political crisis in Russia, or do any of these things. You could argue, in fact, I would argue, that as a use of resources, they are a mistake. Ukraine and the CIA, which is basically running this operation, are expending resources on this air offensive against Russia, which in objective terms is achieving very little. Resources which might have been more effectively spent doing other things, such as perhaps developing more drone defenses for the Ukrainian military on the front lines. Just saying, the Russian attacks on Ukraine, the drone attacks and the missile attacks, are on a far bigger scale. And they are far more powerful, and they are far more organized, and they use now many different types of very sophisticated drones. Drones that some of them can be controlled by air controllers back in Moscow, others which are jet-powered, some of which carry interceptors, some of which carry bombs. I mean, this is an extremely sophisticated drone offensive now, and it's ramping up significantly. We have hundreds of drones every night, and now also in daylight. The Ukrainian defenses are indeed very depleted, apparently. I mean, in across much of Ukraine, they don't exist anymore. And this Russian drone offensive does do serious damage. The one big question about it, for me, is why it's happening now I expected that the Russians would conduct an enormous drone offensive and missile offensive against Ukraine over the winter. Instead, they seem to have been building up their drones, their drone forces during the winter, and they're carrying it out now. But it is on an enormous scale, and its effect is tremendous. And we have information about fuel shortages for the military on the front lines. And all of this is compounding further problems with more reports now that the personnel crisis, the shortage of soldiers is now worse than it's ever been. And I was reading an article in Responsible Statecraft, which said that the recruitment crisis in Ukraine, which has been there now for about, you know, well over, it's about 2 years. We've had people going out into the streets, seizing men in the streets, bundling them into vans and sending them to the front lines. Well, that has apparently now reached the most ruthless and extreme levels that we've seen up to now. And there is now counter-violence against it, and it's becoming more extensive. There's been shooting incidents against recruiters. There's been incidents where boys have attacked recruiters with knives, things of that kind. This is all in from this article in Responsible Statecraft. This has apparently cranked up this year to an even further level. So we have these major resource issues, the heavy drone attacks, the lack of air defense. Russia has air defenses. Ukraine apparently no longer does, not to any degree. The Russians have an operating air force, so they're able to drop bombs. The Ukrainian air force is unable to do that. We don't hear about the F-16s very much anymore. We don't hear much about the Mirage 2000s, which weren't apparently very effective anyway. So we have a situation where the situation in the air, in the sky, is becoming critical. And, well, we come back to what you were saying, that, you know, this talk about the stalemate on the front lines. There is no stalemate on the front lines. And we had a brief ceasefire over the Victory Day holidays. It's ended. The Financial Times published a piece in which it suggested that the Russians had now broken the ceasefire, which, of course, wasn't true. The ceasefire ended. But the Russians now are very much on the attack. They apparently are on the brink of breaking through in Zaporozhye towards Orekhov, which is the key town before the city of Zaporozhye itself. And there's apparently now a gradual collapse of Ukrainian defenses in the town of Konstantinovka. In Slavyansk, things are getting worse and worse. It's clear that the Battle of Donbass is coming to an end, despite, you know, all these denials and all these pretenses that it isn't. And of course, we have the politics of it, which I think we'll come back to. But this is the actual situation in Ukraine today. That same Responsible article, Responsible Statecraft article, said that throughout the war, we have these brief periods of euphoria in the West. Ukraine is winning. The situation on the front lines is stabilizing. We have a stalemate. The Russians are stalled. We've been going through one like that now, but it's coming. It's very soon going to come to an end.
What do you think are going to be the terms from Putin after Donbass? Do you think he can? Do you think Russia is going to take to complete the Donbass operation by autumn? By the end of 2026, let's say? Does that sound reasonable?
I think it sounds perfectly reasonable based on what we're seeing on the front lines at the moment. I think the thing to say is this. The more cities fall the faster it and easier it becomes to capture the remaining ones. So if Konstantinivka, Pokrovsk fell, then after Pokrovsk, Konstantinivka fell. It took time to take Pokrovsk. It's taking apparently rather less time to take Konstantinivka. But then once you've taken Konstantinivka, the remaining places, Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, Druzhivka, begin to look isolated. The supply lines become more difficult to these places. So it starts to become like a row of dominoes. When one falls, it leads to the fall of the other. And the process gradually accelerates. And that's likely, it seems to me, what we're going to see. Also, the pattern of Russian offensives is that they start in the spring, in April, May. They start gradually. They gradually build up momentum. Then during the summer months, we get a rapid acceleration. And then in the late summer, early autumn, you start to see places fall. This is the pattern in 2024. It was the pattern in 2025. I don't see why it shouldn't be the pattern again this year. And what are the places that are going to fall? Well, they're going to fall. It's the key remaining cities in Donbass, because in Donbass, there isn't any more anything else. Now, autumn, well, let's say the end of the year to be more conservative.
And the terms?
Right, now this is where we are going to become, we're going to enter into a much more interesting situation.
Some say Odessa.
Odessa.
Some say just Zaporozhye and Kherson. I mean,
Financial Times article spoke about Kiev and Odessa, that Putin is going to actually demand Kiev itself, that this is even more important for him than Odessa, is taking Kiev. I don't myself think that is what Putin is going to do. I don't think that's what the Russians are going to do. I think they're going to certainly say, look, Ukraine must withdraw from Zaporozhye and Kherson. There must also be a withdrawal from other areas that are, you know, Russian and things of that kind. So, you know, from places maybe along the border and things of that kind. Obviously, they're going to insist that Ukraine finally commit not to join NATO. I think they will also demand that Ukraine commit not to join the EU. I think these are the simple things. But I think the big thing that they're going to demand is that they're going to want a complete reconstruction of the political system in Ukraine. You mentioned federalization in the past. I think they're going to say it's the time has come to move towards federalization. They will demand that Zelensky himself and the elite around him step down. They've already said many times that they don't accept him as the legitimate leader of Ukraine. They're going to say that there should be a new interim government created. They're going to demand that some of the people who make up that interim government should be people from the opposition, people like Azarov, who is currently in Russia, other people like people from the former opposition parties who are also now in exile in Russia. And of course, all of that is going to be unacceptable to Zelensky. He's not going to agree to it. And then the offer from the Russians will not be exactly an offer. It will be more an ultimatum, actually. And then the war will continue. And then we will see an operation towards Odessa. Whether we will see an operation towards Kiev, I am not so sure. But you could argue that the pieces are being put into place to do it. So all of these really strange operations in Sumy and Kharkiv region, they do begin to look like their preparations for an advance on Kiev. And there's been lots of rumors of some kind of a build-up of logistics and transport links and that kind of thing in Belarus, perhaps for an advance towards Kiev from Belarus, as we saw in 2022. Only this time, it will not be 2,000 men turning up and trying to capture an airport with another 20,000 following behind them. It's going to be an army of hundreds of thousands of men, battle-tested, battle-trained, far more armored vehicles, fleets of drones. It will be a completely different operation from the one we saw in 2022.
I think Kiev freaks them out more than Odessa. The Zelensky regime, yeah.
Far more. If they lose Odessa, it's a crisis for Ukraine. But if they lose Kiev, it's not just a crisis for Ukraine, it's a crisis for them. Because without Kiev, it becomes much more difficult for them to say that they are the government of Ukraine anymore. Also, the other thing to say is if they lose Kiev, Ukraine realistically may never get it back. I mean, it's also considered by many people in Russia, not just a Russian city, but the first Russian city, the state where the city where Russia as a state and a nation began. So I'm not saying everybody in Russia thinks that way, but a lot of people do. And I suspect quite a lot of people in Putin's entourage do. Just saying.
Just to wrap up the video, the sources for the Financial Times article were European sources and I believe Ukraine, a Ukraine source, right?
Yes, but they did also
because they're the ones talking about.
Absolutely.
Just to be clear, they're the ones talking about Kiev and Odessa.
Yeah, absolutely. Not
us.
Yes. No, absolutely. And I think that, you know, that is there in that Financial Times article. Now, how well informed about the thinking in Moscow these people really are is a completely different question. The Financial Times did say that they'd spoken to two people who had knowledge of Putin's views. I don't believe the Financial Times has access to people like that, just to say, at least not in Russia.
Right. Okay. We will end the video there, theduran.locals.com. We're on X, we're on Rumble, we're on Telegram. We are also on Substack, so check us out there. All those links are in the description box down below. And go to the Durant Shop, pick up some merch, 30% off all t-shirts on the Durant Shop. Take care.